Welcome back to another episode of Out of the Blank Podcast. Doug, it is a pleasure to have you back and back so soon because I told you we had to talk about your book, Surviving Hiroshima. This is an interest of mine and so many people's, and I'm just happy to be able to speak with you again.
It's always great to do your show. You know, I've gotten to know you a little bit, and I like you. You're a good guy. And I really, really appreciate the fact that you are providing history to a lot of people who maybe didn't get much in school like we used to in the old days. And of course, I've said to you before, those of us who know history does in fact repeat itself. And so those of us who know history frequently have kind of a unique window on the future because it does repeat. So there are lessons absolutely to be learned from history that are useful. So I appreciate the fact that you're out there doing it.
Just before we get into your Hiroshima book, I have to ask from your personal opinion just on the education system teaching history, based on what you've done as a, I would call you a historian, at least a historical biographer in every sense of the word. But what is your opinion on the historical subject being taught in the education system? I've noticed a lot of historians, even ones that work in the school system, seem to have a little bit of a problem with it just because they're limited in scope.
It is so limited. I mean, I have a lot of opinions, Robbie. I have opinions on things I know nothing about. That sounds
Most
easy.
people do.
But no, it is clear that a lot of subjects are not taught the way they once were, and that's tragic. The focus seems to be on social issues, and of course, there's nothing wrong with that. But it's also nice if you actually know something, you know? And so I think history is one of them that's been disregarded. We used to have a class called civics. This is how our government works. I don't think they have that anymore. And so we now have people who know nothing about history, and they really don't know how their government works. They don't know where their tax money goes. They don't know. They just don't know because nobody taught them. And it's tragic. It really is tragic. So, yes, I think there is a great fault, particularly in the area of history, in our school systems, and it's unfortunate, very unfortunate.
We're going to steer this into the Surviving Hiroshima book, but obviously, once you dive into a topic, or I don't know how this book came about or landed in your lap. I don't know if it was like the Howard Hughes book where it was kind of plopped on your desk, but you start realizing that if you can take the time to really dive into a subject, you learn a lot that wasn't told to you. Maybe they gave you the cliff notes, but you realize how fascinating the subject is, which, I mean, with Surviving Hiroshima, how did that land in your lap?
Well, it was interesting. I received a call on my cell phone from my publisher. My publisher never ever calls me on the phone. We're friends, we're great, but it's one of those internet things, you know. So the phone rang, and she said, "Doug, I just had a man call me. His mother survived the atomic bombing of Hiroshima, and they're not Japanese, they're Russian. And he's looking for someone to write a book. And this one, I think, has your name written all over it. Give me his phone number. Give me his phone number." So that was Tony Drago. And a half hour later, we'd sewn it up. I was going to write the book. So it was, in fact, delivered to me right out of the blue. And I just set out a copy of it somewhere, which, of course, I mentioned.
Well, it's right on the wall behind you.
Oh yeah. Oh yeah, I forgot. I just put that up the other day. Yeah, we've had a, as I mentioned earlier, we've had a little electrical drama around here this morning. So I've been kind of, yeah, okay, well, it's right on the wall behind me. So I've been kind of running. And but yeah, that was the beginning. Now what Tony did was give me the family history. And one of the more important things was that his mother, as I said, they were Russian. This story is remarkable. I write historical biographies, But if this were a novel, I would not be able to come up with all the twists and turns that are in this thing that just happened. They just happened in reality. And so Tony gave me the information on his mother, which included interviews that the United States Air Force conducted with survivors of the atomic bombing of Hiroshima. And his mother was the only one who spoke English. So, but not only did he provide me with a transcript of those notes, but he had the actual recordings, which are available anyway. It's not secret, but that was fascinating in itself. Hearing this young woman in 1945, talking to the Air Force about what it was like to have an atomic bomb dropped on her.
Where did Tony get this information? Did he find it from like diaries that were just left in his house?
No, his mother survived the war, and so he grew up hearing little bits and pieces of the story. And I can't remember. He knew that the recordings existed. I don't know how he learned that, but he did. And so he went looking for them, and he found the recordings and the transcript. And that's what he provided me. And that makes this book kind of interesting at another level, because her name is Kalaria Palchikov, and I took as much of her transcript information as I could and directly quoted her. So in a sense, Kalaria is actually telling her own story frequently in the book. Which is something you don't see typically in something that a historian writes, because they're going back through dusty old pages looking for things. Whereas in this particular case, I had not only her exact words in print on the transcript, but I actually heard her saying it. And when you listen to someone who survives something like that, speak in their own words, it's much more moving than reading enough paper. Now, of course, for the people who read the book, they're not going to see that, but I listened to her, and it was moving.
Could you explain how she became a Russian family living in Japan? That's a weird fish out of water scenario, it seems like.
It certainly is. This is one of those things, like I said, I couldn't make this up. Claria's family, the Palchikov family, were part of the Russian aristocracy under the Tsar, last Tsar, Tsar Nicholas. Her father, Sergei, was, of course, they were wealthy, aristocratic, and his father was an extremely talented musician. And when he was a child, his family had a violin custom made for him. That violin actually becomes a character in the story and goes all the way through to the end. But when World War I broke out, Sergei joined the Russian army to fight against the Germans. And while, you probably know this, while World War I was going on, the Bolsheviks challenged the Tsar to see who was going to run Russia. And they took enough control to organize a truce with Germany. And so the Russian troops came home. Well, the Bolsheviks continued to assert their power to the point where there was a civil war. And Sergei joined the Bolsheviks formed the Red Russian Army to fight the revolution. Sergei joined the White Russian Army as a colonel to fight against them in support of the Tsar. Well, the White Russians were basically, Sergei and his group were forced all the way across Russia, right up against the Sea of Japan, and they had nowhere to go. To make things even more complicated, the Bolsheviks would murder everyone. They couldn't leave their families behind because they would be killed. So Sergei was commanding this White Russian force of his men, his troops, and their families. And they all marched across, all the way across Russia till they hit the Sea of Japan. Kalaria was born in Vladivostok just shortly before the White Russian or the Red Russian army arrived. So Sergei had command of this group of people, nowhere to go except the ocean. He had nowhere to, nothing. You couldn't figure out, what am I going to do about this? And he knew, and the White Russian, or the Red Russian army.
To be honest with you, you're doing great so far, I can tell you that.
Okay, thanks. The Red Army was about a day and a half away from Vladivostok, and they, you know, they knew they wouldn't win, so they essentially were about a day and a half away from dying. And Sergei was in the harbor of Vladivostok, and he looked out and he saw a cargo ship, and he said, "Well, that's my answer." So he got his troops and their families together, and they walked aboard this cargo ship, and he said to the captain, "Excuse me, I hate to interrupt, but we're hijacking your ship and you're taking us to Japan." And that's what happened. Got everybody on the cargo ship and off they went to Japan. And the captain of the ship, well, you know, we can imagine he probably wasn't real happy about having his ship hijacked. I mean, who would be? But as they, on the voyage to Japan, he spoke with Sergei and he went, "Well, wait a minute, these are pretty good people. They're just fighting for their lives. I'm kind of okay with that." So he said to Sergei, "If you have your troops surrender their arms to me, then you will be my guests on this ship, and you will enter Japan as my guests, as political refugees, and not as hijackers, so you won't go to jail." And so that's how that came off. They ended up in Japan. Of course, they had nothing, and there was no such thing as you know, welfare for immigrants. Couldn't speak the language, couldn't do anything. But he could play the violin. So after a little bit of trying his hand at carpentry or whatever came his way, he got the idea of forming a small orchestra. Now, this was in the early 1920s, and motion pictures were still silent. And so there was a small band or a piano or an organ or something in the theater to provide sound. And so he did that. And they actually became popular. They ended up on the radio, and you know. And then he was practicing one night in their home, and some woman off somewhere, you know, much of the construction of the homes in Japan is like paper, you know, so sound travels. Someone heard him playing and said, "Hey, how would you like to teach at the school where I teach?" You know, and the whole thing sort of took off from there. So the next thing is he had a very good career as a teacher, as a professional violinist. He had two more children, Nikolai and David, and they were kind of chugging along pretty happy until, you know, World War II, and then everything changed.
That's crazy. That it's, I mean, it brings new terms to the definition, I guess, of everything kind of just works itself out. I mean, through all the hardships that they went through, there was something that, like, at least at the last moment or something, there was that lifeline, or there was something that just happened, and then it took them on a new path.
One of the things that attracted me to this story, and it's very much like we haven't talked about a teenage girl in Auschwitz, but my book on that is the same thing. Human beings are remarkable. They're absolutely remarkable. And this is another thing about history. We go down the streets and we look at this person, we look at that person, and, you know, they're people. You go back into history, into some incredible things that happened, and begin to look at the people who dealt with those situations, and you realize the remarkable strength and courage that's within people. Now, Sergei, he was a pretty tough guy to begin with. That's the way he was. Tough is a wrong word. He was an aristocrat, but, you know, he didn't back down. He
was not shy of hardships.
Yeah, he would take care of the situation. But Kalaria was a baby, and she grew up, of course, in Japan, and then reached the point when the war broke out. She was still fairly young. She was in her late 20s. And when the bomb went off, she jumped into the situation. You know, I say to people, they reach deep down inside themselves and they pull out something they didn't even know was there. And that's what Galeria did. She did remarkable things after.
What do you do in a situation like that when a giant bomb goes off like that? I mean, what was her strategy? What was her explanation of how she was able to, I mean, of that day, the account?
Well, you know, in another one of these twists and turns, now Sergei had actually been teaching Russian to the German military. He was hired to teach classes. But when the war broke out, suddenly, because he wasn't Japanese, he came under suspicion and he was put in prison for a while. It was a pretty big U-turn in life. And that was the first challenge, because the family suddenly, they had been doing very well. Now they didn't have any money, and they, you know, and Galeria hopped in and supported the family while Sergei was imprisoned. But as the war progressed, one day, Japanese troops showed up at their door, and they had a beautiful, beautiful home in downtown Hiroshima. Japanese troops showed up and said, "Everybody out, we're commandeering your house to put Japanese troops in. So pick up what you can carry and get out." And so they went, okay, you know, no choice on that. So Sergei found a little rental house in Yoshida, a fairly close in suburb, and they moved there that same day. And 6 days later, on August 6, 1945, the first atomic bomb ever detonated over a population was detonated over Hiroshima, 500 yards from their old home. They were in Yoshida, just far enough away so that they weren't incinerated, but the house did fall on them. But you can imagine, what are the odds of your minding your own business there? A guy in a uniform shows up, tells you to get out of your house, and 6 days later, your entire city becomes a smoking pile of rubble. Remarkable. I mean, what do you call that, luck? I don't know. What do you call that?
I don't know, make you start believing in the universe, I can tell you that.
Well, I tell you, and there was many more of those. Her shortly before the war broke out, her next in line brother Nikolai decided that he wanted to go to medical school at UCLA. So he moved to California right before the war broke out. He ended up, when the war broke out, he ended up joining the U.S. Army. They used his translation skills, obviously, were handy. So they sent him to the Pacific Theater, where he monitored Japanese radio transmissions. And on August 6th, he heard a transmission. It was from a Japanese commercial station, you know, not a military transmission. It was news that said the entire city of Hiroshima had been destroyed. That meant to him that his family was all dead. And he reported that to his CEO, that Hiroshima had been destroyed, and nobody believed him. He was the first one to hear it. Nobody believed him. And then, I think it was like 11 days or 15 days later, the Japanese, you know, surrender took place, and the surrender was on the United States battleship Missouri in Tokyo Harbor. For the United States, General MacArthur accepted the surrender, and Nikolai, then known as Nick, was selected to be one of the translators at the surrender ceremony, so off he went. So he got to Japan. He did the translation, and he received orders to immediately go to Manila. And so he went to a CO and he said, "Look, I gotta see what happened to my family. I just have to look. I gotta do something." And he said, "Well, they really need you in Manila, but okay, I'll give you 72 hours. That's the best I can do." And so they actually provided him with an American staff car and a Japanese police motorcycle police officer to help him. He went to Hiroshima, but then there was nothing left of it. He went to the family home. The only thing there, aside from burned rubble, he found a post from the top of the bedpost of his bed. That was the only recognizable object that he found. And otherwise, he looked through this great expanse of nothing. Nothing. And he had heard that occasion that some of the families in Hiroshima, they had insurance that actually covered if you get a bomb dropped on you. I don't know if it's...
What's that insurance policy? Somebody get me a quote.
Yeah, that's right. So bicycle accidents, a big bomb falls on you. You know, I don't know. But he was in there. And heard...
Bubonic plague, put that on the side in case that ever breaks out.
And so he'd heard that...
I wonder if his... Wait, he didn't know if his family was still alive, did he?
No, he just assumed they were dead. There was nothing.
If somebody brought up insurance around me and I'm still looking for my family, I'd be a little upset.
Yeah. So he heard that that was going to be one of the days when the insurance guy would show up, and he would come into Hiroshima at a specific place. He'd sit down on the curb because that was all that was left. He had a stack of money, and he would pay off claims. So Nick went to the place where he heard the guy was going to be, thinking maybe somebody would know something. And so with the aid of the Japanese motorcycle policeman, because Nick couldn't recognize his own city. It was just gone. He took him to this place. And as he pulled up, there standing in line waiting to get his claim paid off is Sergei, his father, standing in line. Now, what are the odds of that? I mean, that is just unbelievable. Unbelievable.
I'm surprised that guy was paying off claims. I mean, they'd do anything.
Yeah, I got to tell you, that was...
Sir, my house is ash. I don't know. We can't really say if this was the bomb or not. It could have been a lightning strike. It's like, what the hell? What?
Termites. Well, that is remarkable. And so that was, of course, that was now a big change because he had to scoot back to Manila. But he arranged for, first of all, for his family to get food. When he got back to Tokyo before he sailed for Manila, he had some people say, you know, a bunch of military rations. The United States, of course, now was responsible for providing care for the Japanese people. So he just went to the people in charge and says, hey, this is my family. And they, no problem, buddy. And they just dumped off a load of food. And of course, the family had not had a decent meal for ages. So they were being taken care of. And for Sergei, as a former military man, Nick arranged for him to become the manager of a U.S. Army enlisted man's club. And so he had a job. Then Kalaria, he got a job working at General MacArthur's occupation office. You know, so this all came together. But when the bomb hit, now, of course, as I say, they were just far enough away in Yoshida to, you know, not be incinerated. They crawled out of the rubble. And of course, nobody knew what an atomic bomb was. They had no idea. They didn't even know. They didn't know anything. All they knew is one day everything was here and the next day it was, you know, next second it was gone. And they were standing outside and there was this line of injured people all in shock, bleeding. I mean, you know, walking down the road. The only thing that they knew what to do at that point was get away from Hiroshima in case whatever it was that just happened would happen again. And they were walking by and Sergei looked out and he said to the family, there's the Sea of Japan. Well, the Sea of Japan had always been there. That was no surprise, but they couldn't see it before because before the city of Hiroshima blocked their view and Hiroshima was gone. And, okay, what do we do now? Start walking, I guess. And that's what they did.
It's a good thing that they started walking, though, because if we didn't know about radiation damage back then, so that was a big thing.
Absolutely correct. And the only thing, you know, there was really no reason to stay where they were. First of all, it was a rented house, but, you know, but beyond that, there wasn't anything left of it. It fell down.
My deposit's gone. I hate to laugh at it, but oh my God, it's so traumatic. And like, this is like, I mean, from your understanding and looking at this, I mean, how much of your just knowledge on Hiroshima and the events of that were taught from our perspective in U.S. history about things that happened overseas when it came to the bombings in World War II? I mean, how much did it really change and affect you? Well, I had Peter Kuznick on here, and when he wrote Untold History of the U.S., and when we were going into Hiroshima and Nagasaki, it was a different perspective I'd never seen before. Like, we didn't need to drop those bombs. I think a lot of people know that now, but it was a message of like, hey, this is what we can do. We can test our stuff.
Well, I will tell you, when I was, I'm quite old, you know, I'm
you look fantastic.
And when I was in college, of course, World War II, you know, was still, I'm not going to say it's in the news, but it was, you know, everybody knew about it. Most of our fathers, like my father, was in the infantry, you know, charging all over Europe. And so people knew. And some college class, I had to be in a debate. And one of the topics was, should we or should we not have dropped the bomb on Hiroshima and Nagasaki? Well, this was in the late 60s, and of course, Vietnam was going on and everybody was opposed to war. So everybody was on the, we shouldn't have dropped the bomb side. And, you know, so I took the other side, partially because somebody had to, but also because I was just curious. And one of the things that I discovered then, and I actually dug up the numbers for this particular book, was what would be the human cost between dropping the atomic bombs and an invasion. And the information that President Truman was given at that point, the estimates were pretty wild, but the lowest estimate was that at least 3 million people, military and civilian, would be killed in an invasion, perhaps as high as 10 million. Now, I don't buy the 10 million figure at all, but I think 3 million is pretty comfortable. And one of the reasons for that is that the Japanese code of honor is that you don't surrender, and that includes civilians. And so they expected that in an invasion, the Japanese would defend, Japanese civilians would defend their whole homeland if all they had was a pitchfork. They would do that because that was part of their honor. So there was nothing, there was no reason to believe that when American troops rolled in, that there would be white flags hanging from those houses. They knew they were going to have to fight. Okay, so what was the, so let's say, let's use the lowest estimated figure, which was 3 million. The bomb took, for both Hiroshima and Nagasaki,
it's 610,000, roughly around that range, if I'm not mistaken.
Well, that would probably include injuries or things. I think
later deaths, too, that were counted from radiation and people that were nearby.
Yeah, initially, I believe it was 174,000, but whatever the figure is, let's say it's 600,000, okay, as opposed to 3 million.
No, I'm with you. There's a lot of people don't know this, but it's not, I wouldn't say it's an unpopular opinion. It's just hard. I mean, the overall perspective here is that war is hell, and I wish we didn't have to get into them, but there's faults on both sides and there's casualties on both sides. I wish we didn't have to have war. So it's not that you're choosing, well, this is this and this is this. But if we didn't drop those bombs, the thing that would have happened was Operation Cherry Blossoms at Night, which a lot of people do not realize was Unit 731's plan off the coast of San Francisco. They stopped it as soon as the bombs fell. They canceled all their plans to do so. Like, we're done. We're not doing this. And it was five missiles on these little subs that were underwater that were going to launch these little missiles onto the coast of San Francisco. And these bombs carried 500,000 to a million fleas filled with bubonic plague. Now, I don't know if you know how hard it is to kill a flea. It's damn near impossible, but they were going to drop these. And you got to think, that would have opened up Pandora's box. We probably could have never stopped the contamination of that. They were going to do a bunch of crazy things, had plans like this. Unit 731, which doesn't get recognized in our history, killed more Chinese than we killed Japanese with Nagasaki and Hiroshima, three times over. I mean, their medical experiments were insane, and China does not talk about it because it's seen as a slight against them, and Japan has refused and made an agreement with us not to teach it in our history books. So there's these bits and pieces of history that kind of, if you look into, like I said, why is your job is so important as a historian to be able to just make a biography, find something, write about it, put it in a book, because you get to see something like, nobody thinks Russians were over there. You know, that's new for me.
Well,
and
first
it doesn't
of all,
justify it. Like I said, it doesn't justify it.
There is a huge moral issue here. You know, on the one hand, how do you justify killing that many people who are not combatants? Well, and you just said it. It's not that it's a great idea, but you got to play the hand you're dealt. And that's what we were dealt. So from a statistical point of view, I have to say, yeah, it was a horrible thing. The whole thing was horrible. I think that the bombings were the least horrible of the options on that. But I had have a friend in my area here who's even older than me, and he has a brother who's even older than him. And he brought him to my office one day and said, I want you to meet my brother. He was getting ready to parachute into Japan just before the bomb dropped. And I can tell you, that guy was pretty darn happy that he didn't have to jump, because it was pretty clear that when they parachuted into Japan, they would do whatever mission they were assigned to do, but they wouldn't be coming back. It was a death mission. And
did your perspective change before this book was called up to you by your publisher? Like, were you willing to look into it? A lot of people that come from, you know, like my grandpa, he didn't care anything about the other side. It was all about this side, this country he fought for, the Americans and everything. So I'm curious if, I mean, a lot of your history can be like, oh, I'm not going to look into that, or I'm not going to feel bad because we had to do what we had to do, which is, like I said, it's a rational opinion. But looking at the survivor's account from someone from the opposite side, or even looking at what you would call an opposing perspective, people don't want to do that because they're just either diehard patriots or so I'm curious if you had maybe some hesitation and even writing about it.
That's a very interesting question, which I've never been asked before. And I think I have to say, when I was younger, my position would have been, yeah, let's just, you know, kick ass and take names. But as I've gotten older and had a lot of time to observe people, I have broadened my perspective on that. And Tony Drago, you know, Kalaria's son, we discussed this before I wrote anything. And we agreed we're going to tell the truth, no matter what it is. We're not going to come out as being in favor of dropping the bomb or against dropping the bomb. We're just going to tell the truth. And that's what we did. And we're both very comfortable with that, both very comfortable in that. And so when you look into history, and particularly military affairs, you know, we all want to believe the good old United States would never do anything terrible because we're basically good people. Yeah, well, you know, that's pretty good theory, but we're also human beings. And there's also a certain level of pragmatism that falls into the conflict that occasionally people, no matter who they're fighting for, have to say, okay, this may not be morally correct, but it's what has to be done now to save our situation. And doesn't make it right, never makes it right, but you know, I understand, and the truth is the truth. One of the worst things from my perspective is to conceal the truth. I have a whole big issue with our news media, and a lot of things going on today, where the American people are either getting half a story or they're being outright lied to. And I used to work in the TV news, by the way, so it's not like, you know, I'm foreign to that area. And it's chilling to me, Robbie. It really is. It's chilling. Tell the truth. Tell the truth. Yeah, we don't always look like the good guy. That's the way it was.
Has mainstream media picked up your book, or either bothered to interview about it, or has it been strictly like alternative media? I've noticed in subjects like that.
It's mostly alternative media, and I think for a couple of reasons. The big one, I think, is why I'm very interested in doing your show, is that a lot of people just don't know anything about it. And so from the mainstream media perspective, you know, they kind of look at, well, what do we need to tell the story for? Nobody really knows or cares. And so I think that's part of the problem. Yeah. But no, I get a lot of interest from smaller organizations, news organizations, or niche organizations, military groups. They're the ones who understand and know. And that's fine. For this book, and my latest book, A Teenage Girl in Auschwitz, Wascha Frühlich and the Will to Live. For that book, it never occurred to me exactly while I was writing the book, but as it turns out, there isn't really a long, long line of people wanting to read a book about a 14-year-old girl who was tortured by Nazis. Who would have thought? You know? So,
and they shove Anne Frank down your throat in school.
Yeah. And I get that. You know, if you are a pleasure reader, perhaps you don't want to read that. And I get it. But in that particular book, the lying media, of course, it plays a prominent role because Hitler controlled all of the German media, and the Russian people only heard, not the Russian, the German people only heard what Hitler said they could hear. So, yeah, so the media in the case of this book and the last one, the mainstream kind of stays away from it, and I understand the reasoning, but it doesn't matter to me. I keep going. You know, I just keep going.
What separates your Hiroshima book from all the other books about Hiroshima or Nagasaki that kind of focus on a lot of what the civilian population dealt with?
Well, I think Kalaria's personal statements are huge, first of all, huge. And also, she's a remarkable human being. After the detonation, they left Yoshida and they started walking. Claria's mother had just, she was in the process of recovering from cancer. So they didn't get too far. And then a very nice Japanese family agreed to take them in. In fact, they pretty much agreed to take everybody in. They had a whole house full of strangers and they just said, come on in. And after several days, Claria's mother, Alexandra, was a little better. And so Claria said, I have to do something. I have to do something. And so she left her mother in the care of one of her younger brothers, and the Japanese military had set up a field hospital not too far from where they were. And she went there and she began helping the medical teams treat wounded civilians, primarily civilians. Now, you can imagine that wasn't a pretty sight at all, first of all. Secondly, when that atomic bomb went off, it didn't spare doctors or nurses. It took everybody. So there was a critical shortage of medical personnel. There was a critical shortage of medical supplies. And Kalaria showed up with her two hands and said, I'm here to help. And she did, and she told the story of the people that she saw and the people that she helped, and you know, some of the ones who made it and some of the ones who didn't. But her story shows this remarkable level of personal courage and character that that kind of knocked me off my feet a little bit. I was amazed that a young girl, well, she was a young woman, could out of nowhere, just as a living in a peaceful little family, you know, playing the piano, having a good time, suddenly she's risen to the point of walking into a room where hundreds of people are burned laying on a concrete floor. And she says, "I'm here to help. I'm here to help. Tell me what to do." Remarkable.
I have to ask, when they came to the United States, did they finally got here? So was I got to hear how they at least got here and got safe. There's got to be like a happy point finally of it.
Well, there is. And,
also, did Tony experience or get to see any of his mother's PTSD or anything from this traumatic incident? I mean, just stuff growing up that she just never could not be normal again.
I'll tell you, Claria, Nick had arranged, as I said, for Claria to work at General MacArthur's office. And so she was running one day as she was going to go home. They handed her a file of folders and said, "You have to take these to the other office across town on your way home." So she's fine. She came outside. She missed her bus. She was angry. She stamped her foot on the sidewalk. And she heard a voice behind her yell, "Hey, lady, you need a ride?" Now, I understand she comes from an aristocratic Russian family living in a very socially structured Japanese world. And you don't say, "Hey, lady, do you need a ride?" to someone like that. So she turned around and it was two GIs in a Jeep. And they offered her a ride and she chewed one of them out and then felt bad. So she apologized. Anyway, she took the ride and not the guy that yelled, but the other guy was named Paul Drago, Tony's father. And, you know, they met and fell in love and all of that. So when he was discharged from the Army, he went back to the United States. Claria followed. It took her a while to get through all the paperwork. But when she got to the United States, she became a media celebrity because here's the young woman who survived having an atomic bomb dropped on her. So they were married on a big network radio show. And she there used to be a show. It started on radio. When I was a kid, I saw it on TV. It was called Queen for a Day. On Queen for a Day, a bunch of average housewives would be on the show. And the object of the show was, who could tell the most horrible story about their life?
Oh.
And the winner then got a washing machine or something.
So it's like The View.
Yeah. And so so Claria was on Queen for a Day. And on the episode that she was on, she was the only one who had an atomic bomb dropped on her.
I know. That's like the Uno card. Like, there's nothing you could beat that. It's like an ace of spades in the deck.
Yes, really. And so that was...
I got a flat tire? Oh, yeah. I got a bomb dropped on me.
And so that's how their life went for a while. And but one of the things she did was Mutual Radio put her on a network show with the tail gunner on the Enola Gay that dropped the bomb. And his name is completely slipping my mind at the moment. I'm not going to look him up. But anyway, now, of course, he was the only one who actually saw the bomb detonate. And it's interesting, I didn't know this before. Since he was going to be able to see the bomb detonate, the Air Force gave him a motion picture camera. And so he actually took the film of the bomb, you know, exploding. Well, of course, they had a reconnaissance aircraft up there as well, shooting motion picture film. All those cameras failed. Only the tail gunner's footage was any good. And so when you see the bomb explode over Hiroshima, it's from the guy sitting in the tail gunner seat. Now, actually, I don't think that was the question you asked me, but yes, they went on the radio show together to discuss the bombing from the perspective of the guy who was on, in the bomber that dropped the bomb, and Kalaria, who was the recipient of the bomb. And that was a pretty interesting experience, which, of course, was very emotional for both of them. But once again, human beings being remarkable people, listening to their remarkable stories, as far as I'm concerned, is well worth the dive into history.
When you mentioned the person yelling at her from a Jeep or yelling from behind her, I thought it was the insurance guy. Being like, we found out your house burned down before the bomb fell. Gonna need that money back.
Again, I can sell you another policy, so that'll never happen.
All right. Now I have to ask about how hard was it if you even bothered actually to look for Freedom of Information Act requests. I mean, we mentioned secrecy from our government, but stuff that kind of gets hidden away and not really explained. Did you ever try and find documentation or anything to allude to some incidences when it came to the dropping of the bombs to maybe lead up to a beginning before preface to the actual bombs being dropped?
I didn't find anything that had been, at least, if there was anything hidden or disguised, I never got wind of it, so I didn't go looking for it. Of course, in the book, I did put a little bit of information. One of the things on this story, like in some of my others, is I have to approach this with the assumption that perhaps my reader really doesn't know anything about it. So I have to tuck away some things in there to sort of build a foundation for the story. And so I didn't feel that I could just say, and then they made an atomic bomb and took it to Japan. I thought, well, what's an atomic bomb? What? How did that come together? And so I did research that, and I put enough of it in there so people would understand the concept and how it was made. Not to the point where anybody can whip one up in their basement. There were obviously enormous secrecy around how that was carried out, and much of it was remained secret for quite a while. There's an interesting thing that happened with that as well. And now I wasn't going to talk about this. I can't remember this guy's name either. But within the Manhattan Project, which was the group that built those first two atomic bombs, there was a Russian spy.
Yep.
And before they dropped the bomb, President Truman spoke to Joseph Stalin and said, hey, we got this, new weapon. We're going to use it. And he said, yeah, go ahead. Well, at that point, Stalin knew more about the atomic bomb than Truman did. It was just amazing to me. Which this is something leads to another thing that gets batted around frequently incorrectly. The Red Scare starting in the late 40s and going.
Good old McCarthyism.
The McCarthyism, and people light their torches and they go, I'm not gonna defend the way that was handled, but they leave out the part that they found 360 spies in the State Department while they were at that. I mean, not some Hollywood actor with a big mouth. I mean, they found real spies. So, hey, this is this coin has two sides.
I still stick by RFK's quote, where RFK was quoted in those hearings talking about that there was more FBI informants in the free play for Cuba committee than the actual Cuban communists or whatever he said that towards the end. But because it was true, there's actually more informants and a lot of those Cuban kind of Castro supportive groups than there actually was like people that were involved in the Free Play for Cuba committee, which I didn't know about.
All of that is quite interesting. And of course, then you get into the conspiracy theories about
JFK.
I hate to use the word conspiracy theory because that automatically sort of colors it as being untrue. And I don't believe
me and Mark had a back and forth about this because we don't really agree on the, I sent him a bunch of documents when he was explaining something about the JFK stuff. And he was like, wait, you've done like your research. I was like, whether that was sarcastic or not, I was like, things that you can't explain that are unexplainable and things like the JFK stuff is like, why did Gerald Ford move the back wound up 6 inches to the back of the throat? That is verifiably proven. That's not conspiracy. That's not skepticizing or anything like that. It's he did that to match and back the report's findings. Also, if you read the actual intelligence investigations by the Select Committee, it says that based on the assumption that Lee Harvey Oswald was the lone assassin, all evidence that points towards that. They didn't look at any more evidence. I mean, they eliminated a getaway driver within 48 hours, which is just ridiculous. You don't do that if you're actually in an investigation. So there's a lot of stuff like in history where it's like you have to really dig into it and hopefully you don't fall down like this tremendous rabbit hole. But I mean, I find it more – I mean, what are your thoughts on documentaries – like doing a part in the public's consciousness or perception of things? Because in my opinion, from what I've talked to with historians that have studied like propaganda and film and everything like that, it's completely left this area of like the Vietnam War as being like a, I don't know, like, how do I feel? I feel empty inside is what I feel. Because that's always how they've displayed it, in either black or black and white or some grayish overtones in the actual scene when they're in Vietnam to we dropped and we burned stuff. But at the same time, we didn't know because there's people in trees, and it leaves this whole area of confusion. And that generation did not talk about it at all. Only thing you can get out of them is that they loved, they were a Coca-Cola family. And that's because the people that produce Coke also helped produce Agent Orange, which I did not know about.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, that's crazy, isn't it? Yeah.
Oops. Sorry.
They had a subsidiary corporation that also helped produce some of the chemical agents for the Vietnam War. That's why all these military people, Coke sponsored, gave them all Cokes. That's why every Vietnam movie, like, you, to be authentic, if they drank a Coke, my grandpa was like that. He said he served in the war, but we were like, which war? He just never explained, but we're all 100% sure it's Vietnam. Mostly because we have documents to show that, yeah, he was in Vietnam. He just never explained the Vietnam part to it, but he was like, we're a Coca-Cola family. And that's a lot with all these old GIs. They're all strictly loyalties to Coke because Coke not only funded them with free Coke, but also their chemical department happened to work with some chemicals during the war.
One of the possible side effects of studying history is that your head might explode when you start getting into these areas.
I love it. I'm great at trivia.
Oh, you talked about documentaries.
Yes.
And of course, as a former, you know, producer and director, you know, I've made a couple, I've made some. And I kind of reflect on that periodically because the question is the documentarian obligated to present both sides of the story, or may the documentarian just go full force, this is what I think, what I believe, which then, of course, would be propaganda. Now, as someone who makes those kinds of films, your documentary is much stronger if you actually take a shot at presenting at least part of the other story, or, you know, the other side. But it's a good question. How much can the documentarian's personal feelings be presented without turning the thing into propaganda? I've never personally, when I've been involved with that, I've never had anything that was that much of a hot issue that I had to be concerned about my own feelings. But certainly my position would be, if nothing else, for the sake of, you know, making it a stronger product, to present both sides to the, yeah, to some degree at least. And
how do you feel about it educating people of my generation? It's kind of now the new form. It's not necessarily, and I would say documentaries have made a rise on Netflix, is really mostly the true crime stuff, which I don't know why people are so damn fascinated with Jeffrey Dahmer. But there's a large focus in documentaries now being a role as an educator in a lot of people's lives or a lot of people's interests that sparked them researching something a little bit deeper. And I'm curious from a perspective of someone that, you know, got a lot of their stuff from news and a lot of stuff like when that was really, really big. Now it's kind of died down over my generation. But what are your thoughts on documentaries playing the role as educator?
First of all, I'd rather be shot than watch a network newscast. Let's just start with that premise.
Line them up.
Well, obviously, motion pictures and things including, you know, interactive media are fascinating, useful tools for educating people. And, you know, you can cram a lot of stuff into a 60-minute documentary that would take people, you know, a while to read in a book. So I think the premise of using it as a tool, the moving image as a tool is certainly a great idea, but it all falls down to who's making that image, you know, who's driving the train here, you know, because if you have a corrupt, I like the word corrupt, that yeah. works so often lately. If you have a corrupt media creator, they will create a corrupt product which will corrupt minds. It gets back to what I said earlier. Tell the truth. Tell the truth. And believe me, well, I don't have to tell you. You know better than, you know, most how much misinformation, disinformation, lies are packaged and fed to the public who, for some reason, still don't seem to know it's coming. You know, they haven't always been able to separate that. It's scary. It's scary.
What's a takeaway you want people to have after they read your book? Like the overall message that you want to kind of project out there?
There's a, of course, obviously big historical messages here, but I think that I would encourage people to carefully consider how Kalaria responded to the situation. I mean, I barely touched on things that she did, but you know, we can't be here all day. To look at that young woman's character and how she responded to the situation, and that is a model. She's a model for not just what young women could do, but everyone, and they don't have to be young. Same thing with Sergei. You couldn't, you know, it's a, as I go through with the written book with him, no matter what happened, he just dealt with it. He just dealt with it. You know, that's what I do. I deal with things. And you look at people like that, and then, you know, we look around and see a lot of people who seem to melt down for reasons that I don't believe are very good.
Menu anxiety is a new thing now. Kids getting anxiety off too many menu options or not enough menu options. They get anxiety of it. And I just think of that, like my grandfather wasn't diagnosed with like a mental illness, but he was always in the backyard with a metal detector looking for Charlie in a hole somewhere. But he did find an illegal gambling operation, surprisingly. So it's like, what do you say to the guy when you're making fun of him for being like nut jobish with like a metal detector out in the backyard? And then he actually does find an illegal gambling operation.
That's true. Sometimes facts are kind of tough to handle, you know?
I'm just like, I can't argue with him anymore. At this point, we can keep calling him crazy, but if he's right, he's right. So it doesn't hurt if he's in the backyard, as long as he's not hurting anybody.
I believe that in this book, and also very much so in A Teenage Girl in Auschwitz, people should look at Kalaria and this book and Basha and the other book. Basha was only 14 years old when she was sent to Auschwitz. You know, that's a pretty brutal transition into adolescence. And look at what they did. Look at how they responded to the situation. And that's what I would like, I think, most of all, people to understand that there is strength within us that we may not know is there unless we're challenged. But if you consider that, if you have that belief that it's in there somewhere, and you know, you don't have to have a full-fledged crisis to pull that out. You don't have to have an atomic bomb dropped on you or to be sent to a concentration camp. What you have to have is the understanding that the individual is probably much, much more capable emotionally than they may believe they are. And if you know that, you're more likely to keep going when things get tough. Because quitting doesn't get you anywhere. The game's over when you quit. All right. Well, okay, if I go back in the ring for the third round here, he's going to hit me. Yeah, he's going to hit you. But you'll make it to the fourth round and the fifth, and who knows? Maybe he'll go down in the sixth. We don't know. All we know is that we can't stop. And that requires courage. And I absolutely believe there's a level of that in each of us that most have not found. I happened to discover this on my own through crisis. You know, I didn't know it was there until I got backed up against the wall and said, oh, okay, what's going on here? And when I pushed through, I went, I didn't know I could do that. I had no idea. And then from that point on, it takes a lot to rock my boat. It just does.
You need enough pressure on a coal to create a diamond.
You got it. Absolutely. Absolutely.
Doug, where can people find your links and where can people find your books?
They can find all of my books on DouglasWellmanAuthor.com. I'll show you this. You've already seen the cover, but this is my interviewer book copy that I didn't take one single look at. How about that? I'm so proud. DouglasWellmanAuthor.com. You can go to, on say, Amazon.com, just put books, Douglas Wellman. All my books are there. It's more likely to find in an online retailer than in a bookstore, simply because there are so many books published every week that a bookstore can't possibly stock them all. And, you know, my books are kind of a niche market. As I say, in the case of the Auschwitz book, it's not like thousands of people are lined up to buy a book about a 14-year-old girl tortured by Nazis. So, you know, more likely to find my material online than in a bookstore.
And I will link all your links in the description. It's been a pleasure chatting with you, Doug. And thanks, everybody, for listening to this episode of Out of the Blank. Stay tuned for our next episode.